There's a way to make an entrance.
My destiny.
It was now a conspiracy of witches.
Download Veely today. In the mid-1970s, New York City was plunged into terror.
I can't tell you what effect this series of crimes had on the city of New York.
People in the area lived in a great deal of fear.
Innocent young couples were being slayed on the streets.
There was no rhyme or rhythm or reason. I had no idea where he was going to pop up next.
Literally, everybody who walked the streets were terrified.
The killer called himself the Son of Sam.
When he got the urge to kill, he would scan the streets of the city of New York.
But what made him murder? Was he warped by his experiences?
This was a terribly, pathetically lonely young man.
Or was the Son of Sam born to kill?
These individuals are hardwired so that their killing is part of their sexual arousal pattern.
It's changed. This used to be a park house somewhere in the middle over here before they renovated this park years back.
In the summer of 1977, after meeting just a week earlier, 20-year-olds Robert Violante and Stacy Moskowitz were out on their first date.
We had gone out to a movie first, and then we drove over here to where we're sitting now. We came out into the park, it was a summer night, it was nice out, and we felt like two little kids. I said, how about we go play, let's go play in a swing for a little while. When I had walked by the park, I had just saw some guy hanging out and didn't think anything of it. And then we had gone into my car, we sat in my car. And then the next thing, all I remember was hearing a couple of loud noises, like bangs. The first thing I had heard was a moan coming from Stacy. No, I couldn't see her because I was totally blinded. Something clicked in my head that we must have been shot. But, oh my God. We're dead.
The attack was to be the final chilling act of the most notorious killer in New York's history. The 29th of July, 1976, 1 year earlier, 18-year-old Donna Laurie and her friend, 19-year-old Jody Valenti, are sitting in a parked car, talking after a night out. A man approaches, draws a gun, and fires three times. Donna is killed almost instantly, but Jody survives and can describe the shooter.
In most police departments, they have what they call sketch artists. And in these particular incidents, the survivors of these shootings, we got sketches.
The gunman was a stocky white male with curly or bushy hair. And crucially, unlike most New York homicides, he had no known connection to the victim. Over the following winter months of 1976, there would be two further unprovoked shootings, injuring four more victims, this time in the borough of Queens.
The memory of the case is seared in my memory for all time, like all other New Yorkers who were around at that time. These killings began as sort of random events.
There was no rhyme or rhythm or reason.
However, there were similarities between the crimes.
Many of the shootings took place in dark Lover's Lane areas where, you know, young people might be parking, and a man would approach and open fire.
Clearly a serial sexual murder, in my judgment. Take a look at who he's shooting. He's shooting women. He's shooting them in lovers' lanes. These individuals are hardwired so that their behavior, their killing, is part of their sexual arousal pattern. That's why they repeat it, because it is so sexually arousing and sexually stimulating.
On the 30th of January, 1977, another shooting. Detective Sergeant Joseph Coffey was assigned to the case.
I was called in to investigate a homicide that occurred in Queens County. It was the homicide of a girl named Christine Freund, and she was sitting in a car with a boyfriend.
26-year-old Christine and her boyfriend John had returned to their car after a night out, when without warning, a gunman opened fire.
And it was a brutal killing. She was shot in the head several times.
As with the first three attacks, the shooter was unknown to the victims and had immediately fled the scene of the crime. The evidence began to point to a serial killer.
It became apparent that the same weapon, a 44 caliber revolver, was being used in all of the killings.
But ballistics results were inconclusive.
Ballistics of the bullets involved did not match because of the nature of the type of gun that was used. It was a 44 caliber Charter Arms Bulldog. That gun was fashioned for sky marshals. And the gun was of such a nomenclature that it was made that you could fire it from within an aeroplane and not penetrate the fuselage. So that means the ballistics of the bullet coming out of the gun was limited.
5 weeks later, just one street away, the gun was used again. Nineteen-year-old student Virginia Voskarichian was found dead.
She was shot in the street by an unknown perpetrator who came up to her and fired at her, and she had put her school books up in front of her, and the bullet went through the school books and lodged in her brain. We were able to compare the bullet that we recovered from her skull to the original shooting that we took from the body of Donna Loria. Because we were able to do that, we were able to determine that we had a serial killer.
Five attacks had left three dead and four injured. And now news spread that a serial killer was stalking the streets of New York.
People were afraid to go out. It was a terrifying experience.
I mean, it was a time where one man could terrorize an entire city of 8 million people. Literally, everybody who walked the streets, particularly women, were terrified.
But the mystery killer's reign of terror had only just begun. In early 1977, the citizens of New York had been plunged into panic by the news that a serial killer was loose on their streets. Five attacks had already left three dead and four wounded. And in the early hours of the 17th of April, the killer struck again. Detective Joseph Coffey is called to the Bronx.
That shooting, he killed two people, a boy and a girl in a car, again, having a liaison in the car, and he came up and killed both of them.
20-year-old Alexander Esau and 18-year-old Valentina Suriani had both been shot twice. As usual, the killer had fled the scene. But this time, there was a twist.
In the shooting in the Bronx, a letter was left. The letter was addressed to Captain Joseph Borelli, who was working the case with me.
In part, the letter read, "I am a monster. I am the son of Sam. I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else. Programmed to kill." Although police didn't know it, it had been written by a 23-year-old resident of an apartment block in Yonkers, David Richard Berkowitz. So who was this hunter who called himself the son of Sam? And had he, as he claimed, been programmed to kill?
His past life had a significant bearing, I believe, on whom his victims were.
David Berkowitz was born Richard David Falco on the 1st of June 1953. The result of an extramarital affair, he was immediately given up for adoption to childless couple Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz.
The Berkowitzes doted on their adopted son, but Berkowitz was very much like his adoptive parents socially in that he was isolated and quite lonely. He had very poor social skills and was regarded in the Bronx community where he was brought up as a bit of a bully and a loner.
The young Berkowitz would have sudden outbursts of anger and violence, leading to his adoptive parents taking him to a psychiatrist.
Of interest is that he always had tried to belong in his school. He didn't fit. He was kind of a loner, but not in the sense that you would be worried about him. He had no behavior problems, but he also had no friends that he felt close to.
Throughout his adolescence, there is no recorded incidence of Berkowitz having a girlfriend. It's interesting to speculate that his choice of targets are usually young women or young courting women who are in the company of their boyfriend might be seen as a way of Berkowitz acting out his inability to establish his own form of relationship with a girlfriend.
At 14 years old, Berkowitz would be devastated by the death of his adoptive mother, Pearl, from breast cancer.
This seems to have been a crisis in his life. His grades at school will dive. He loses his faith in God and so forth. And especially the kind of underlying problems that Berkowitz, the adult, is going to show are going to become exacerbated when his adoptive father remarries and he does not get on with his new stepmother, and his feelings of being isolated, of women abandoning him, become more and more exacerbated.
At 18, he joins the army.
He went off into the service, spent a year in Korea, spent a year in no uncertain terms of just getting intoxicated on drugs every single day.
After serving overseas, Berkowitz was then posted back to the US, stationed in Virginia.
No drugs anymore, and instead we have a very, very lonely young man, not knowing what to do with himself, who finds himself in the midst of a very intense Baptist region. And in the fullness of time, he converts. But this is not somebody who really has found God, but really of wanting to be accepted and loved by others, This was a terribly, pathetically lonely young man.
Disillusioned with army life, Berkowitz quits and returns to New York. He makes contact with his natural mother, who reveals the circumstances of his birth and adoption.
He found out who his real parents were. It turned out his mother's married name was Italian, and that the man by whom she had fathered the child was Jewish. They had an extramarital affair. And this, I think, plays a direct role in whom he was watching, which couples he sought out. They were either Italian or Jewish. And he would later write this, or say this, that he was in effect displacing his resentment at his parents, real parents, for having had him and then put him up for adoption, that is, as he would view it, abandoned him.
Living alone in New York, Berkowitz finds work as a security guard and a taxi driver. He develops an obsession for starting fires.
Berkowitz set 1,488 fires before he started killing people. How do we know that? He documented it very carefully in his diary.
No real intent for damage, but to be able to call out for help or for succor or support by turning in a fire alarm and watching the fire engines come out. That's what he was so seeking of some kind of external response.
These fires, in my judgment, were sexually motivated as well, because look at the power and control that you can have by setting a fire. You could set a building on fire, a car, a field. And for these individuals, that type of control is eroticized. It's sexually stimulating to them to do that type of thing.
In 1976, Berkowitz moved to a top-floor apartment in Yonkers, New York. Neighbors began to notice strange incidents.
There was many dogs being killed, primarily German Shepherds. It seemed like every day a dead dog would turn up in the neighborhood, either here, back in the woods behind the house, in the woods at this end of the house, or the woods over at that end. And fires, frequent fires in this area, including the same apartment number in the various buildings, 1, 2, and 3. The house you can see far back there, apartment building, almost took off the whole corner of the building.
One neighbor in particular was singled out for special attention.
David Berkowitz lived in the back far corner of the building, and if you look down, you would see a street that was on, that Sam Carr's house was on. Sam Carr had a black Labrador that lived in the backyard in a doghouse.
Sam Carr's dog would bark incessantly through the night. Berkowitz began writing anonymous threatening letters to Sam, eventually shooting and injuring the dog.
He has underlying mental health problems, in which it's not a question of switching on and switching off those mental health problems. It's a question of his disordered thinking is actually what patterns his consistent behavior day in, day out.
In June 1976, David Berkowitz travels to Texas and pays a surprise call on a former army acquaintance, Bill Parker.
Berkowitz showed up unexpectedly at his house and said, "I'd like to buy a weapon, but in Texas you need a driver's license to buy a weapon." So Parker accommodated him and went into a pawn shop. Berkowitz pointed out the .44 caliber Charter Arms revolver, and Parker bought it, and then he gave it to Berkowitz, not knowing that a few weeks later the Son of Sam killings would begin in New York City.
By the spring of 1977, Berkowitz had claimed the lives of 5 young people. But his reign of terror was far from over. By April of 1977, serial killer, the son of Sam, had claimed the lives of five victims and injured more in a series of attacks that had sent shockwaves through the city of New York. On the 19th of April, in an effort to quell the growing hysteria and track down the killer, police established the Omega Task Force.
Operation Omega was the task force set up for the purpose of capturing him in the act of one of his shootings. We combined the detective forces, which were investigators from all over New York City, with the patrol force, which were the uniform cops in New York City, to the point where we had 300 to 400 detectives and uniform patrols on the streets of New York, particularly in the boroughs of Queens and the Bronx, looking to catch this individual in the act of committing his crimes.
On the 30th of May, while hundreds of officers were trying to track him down, the son of Sam spoke out again. This time, writing to the New York Daily News. The letter began, "Hello from the gutters of New York City, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine and blood. Hello from the sewers of New York City, which swallow up these delicacies when they are washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of New York City, and from the ants that dwell in these cracks and feed on the dried blood of the dead." It continued, "I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam."
These individuals are very often highly narcissistic, and it's not unusual at all for them to want publicity, to follow the publicity in the media, and to get some sort of stimulation as a result of that, because in their mind, they think that they're smarter than the police, they're smarter than everybody.
People were very nervous, apprehensive. They saw ghosts in all the shadows. Girls cut their hair, long hair that made it short, changed the color. The nightclubs, bars, dance halls, all losing business. Streets were empty. Everybody was just terrified.
Night after night, a massive task force patrolled the streets across New York and staked out lovers' lanes. But no one knew if, when, or where the killer might strike again. On June the 26th, they found out.
As soon as we got here, we knew it was the son of Sam. Yeah, it was a hot summer night, 1977. And that particular night, I got a call over the air that a shooting occurred at this location, which occurred right up the block here. Two young people in the car, both shot. Discotheque here, with hundreds of young people inside. Patrol cars all over the place, a scene of panic, people in the streets. The uniformed police responded, cordoned off the area. We conducted our forensic investigation, and we also canvassed the area of witnesses.
Although injured, both victims survived and were able to describe the attack.
As both people came out of the club, went into the car, he showed up exactly like he did in prior occasions, two people making out in the car, and he came up behind them and fired into the car, firing at the girl and hit the male also.
Stalking, hiding up, trying to catch lovers unawares would be very much part of what would give a sexual thrill. He's invading a space which should be private.
So far, all the attacks had taken place in the boroughs of Queens or the Bronx, and most of the female victims targeted had had long dark hair. It was on the 31st of July, 1977, when 20-year-old Robert Violante had set out for his first date with the young girl he'd met a week earlier.
The night before, I was out in one of our local nightclubs that we hung out in all the time. And I was standing outside in front, just getting some air with a buddy of mine. And I had said to Louis, I said, Louis, you ever hear the expression, you feel it in your bones, you got that gut-wrenching feeling? I said, Louis, I just have it in my gut that he's going to either hit Brooklyn tonight or tomorrow night, meaning Saturday night. I just knew it. I just felt it. The next night, that same feeling was like a million miles away from me. Had no feeling at all. But I won't forget leaving my house, and as I was walking down the stairs, my mom turned to me and said, Robert, just be careful. And I turned to her and I said, don't worry, not this guy. I said, she's a blonde.
Later that night, Robert and Stacy were sitting in his parked car when three shots rang out.
The bullet entered directly into my eye and came straight across. And, I lost the left eye. It destroyed everything on the left side. And it did a lot of damage on my right eye.
20-year-old Stacy had also been hit in the head.
So instinctively, I remember that right outside my door was a lamppost. Just came out, and I wrapped it around this way. And this hand, my right hand, went into ringing the horn. I knew to get attention, and I was just screaming at the same time, help us, we've been shot, we've been shot.
The young couple were rushed to hospital. Robert lost one eye and most of the sight in the other. 36 hours after the attack, Stacy Moskowitz was pronounced dead.
I felt terrible. I really did. She was such a sweet girl. Even though I had only met her on my first date, I just knew she was a very, very sweet girl.
It was the first time the Son of Sam had struck in Brooklyn. Detective Ed O'Sullivan was assigned to the case.
The homicide squad in Brooklyn, during that homicide, was so positive. They were up. They were, we're going to get them. You can just feel it. I said, you came to the wrong place, buddy.
A few days later, an eyewitness came forward. They had spotted a suspicious-looking man near the scene of the crime. They described how he looked agitated after receiving a parking ticket. The Brooklyn detectives traced the ticket and vehicle.
Was registered to David Berkowitz with an address in Yonkers.
The name of the car owner was one they had seen before amongst thousands of tip-offs.
A company called IBI had some information about a guy named Berkowitz who worked for them, who was a bit of a nut job. You ought to look into him. So we started to look into him. Also at that time, we got an individual who called us and came into our office by the name of Sam Carr, who said to us, I have a lunatic who lives near me. He shot my dog, and his name is David Berkowitz. And then we have the parking violation ticket on the car at the scene of the killing of Stacy Moskowitz. 2 + 2 + 2 equals David Berkowitz.
On the 10th of August, police assembled in Yonkers.
It was a hot summer day, and it was unusual in the sense that this is a very quiet neighborhood. Commonly, you see a police car out here on occasion. This day, there was a conglomerate of them. They were up and down the street this way, one right in front of my house, and on the street far up there, there was about four or five of them. David Berkowitz came out of the building, seemingly oblivious to the world, and walked to his car, which had been right over about where that silver car is, right over there. As soon as he opened the door, he got into his car, they surrounded him.
At that time, the two detectives got out of the car. One name was John Filatico, the other one was Sergeant Gardella. Filatico went up to the driver's side of the car. Berkowitz was already in the car. He had his gun out, and he said, "Put your hands on the dashboard and don't move." Berkowitz turned to Detective Filatico and said, "You got me." Filatico says to him, "Who do I have?" He says, "You have the Son of Sam." And on the seat in the car that he was sitting in was a paper bag. In that paper bag was the .44 caliber gun that did all of the shootings.
He was done in by a parking ticket. Had that parking ticket not been placed on his vehicle, I don't know how many other people he would have shot or killed before he was apprehended.
Once in custody, Berkowitz would make an extraordinary claim.
He got messages because the dog spoke to him. And when the dog spoke to him, according to Berkowitz, relaying the message from the devil, it was time to kill. That's when he went out and killed.
In August of 1977, 24-year-old David Berkowitz admitted he was the Son of Sam, a serial killer who had terrorized the streets of New York for a year.
The night he was caught, there was all sorts of celebrations. They were giving away drinks in all the bars.
With Berkowitz in custody, investigators would now try to discover what had motivated his crimes. Interviewing him for the first time, Detective Sergeant Joseph Coffey could never have predicted Berkowitz's explanation.
We spoke to him about each killing, how he did it, in detail from A to Z. For 3 hours, he sat there and he never blinked his eyes and he had a constant smile on his face. And he went through chapter and verse of every shooting and killing that he did from the first one to the night we captured him. He told us that his motivation was his connection to the devil. The devil told him to kill these women. The devil told him when to do it, and the devil communicated to him through the dog that belonged to Sam Carr. He felt that the devil had a power over him, and he had to go out and do the devil's bidding.
He was being compelled. He was told to go out and seek victims. When he killed a young lady, she would be possessed and used by these ulterior forces. But at the end of a year, he could then have the young lady.
Quite clearly, he's paranoid, and quite clearly, he's also schizophrenic. So I think what's driving David Berkowitz is ultimately the voices he hears in his head telling him to satisfy those voices, he needs to take other people's lives.
When Berkowitz told us that he was doing these killings and these shootings at the behest of the devil, we looked at each other that we are definitely dealing with a lunatic here.
The judge ordered that a competency hearing be held with respect to Berkowitz. Now, this is common, of course, in any case where the court suspects mental illness.
There was what we called the insanity plea, where if you had a severe mental illness and you didn't appreciate your wrongfulness of your conduct, you would be found essentially not guilty by reason of insanity.
Dr. Daniel Schwartz was asked to assess Berkowitz's mental state.
At the time I examined him for the court, I and my associate studied him many, many hours.
It was to see whether or not he was able to face his criminal charges, or conversely, whether or not he was so overwhelmed by mental illness that it prevented him from rationally addressing his charges.
You have to ask the question, would they have actually abducted the victim if there was a police officer or two standing around? And the answer is no, because they didn't want to get arrested. So they can control it to some degree, but they choose not to control it.
Of course, he was mentally ill to do this. Whether or not he was legally responsible, probably in retrospect, probably, because he chose darkness in which to commit the crimes, and he invariably left the crime scene, suggesting by his behavior that he knew that what he was doing was wrong.
Berkowitz's modus operandi was very simple. When he got the urge to kill, he would scan the streets of the city of New York, and he would drive around looking for an opportunity to kill.
He went at times to appropriate places where he knew that a couple would drive to have a little privacy and to be romantic.
He wasn't a process-focused killer. In other words, he didn't enjoy being in the company of his victims, torturing his victims, staying with his victims. He was an act-processed serial killer. In other words, what he wanted to achieve was simply the death of his victims. Because he was a hit-and-run killer, often showing just a great deal of random behavior, it was much more difficult for the police to be able to catch him.
Although Berkowitz had confessed to the attacks, there were fears that a trial might see him found not guilty by reason of insanity.
After several weeks, he told me that he was feeling increasingly depressed, regretful, guilty for what he had done.
Berkowitz was allowed to consult with a preacher.
There was a Baptist woman. She saw him. And I'll never forget what happened. She saw him alone. He would ask her a question. She would then talk to God. God would then ostensibly answer her, and she would repeat the answer to David. And when they came out an hour later, she went on her way. He walked down the hall towards me. He had this incredible glow on his face that he had just met God again. And so he came out of this informing me and his attorneys that he was going to plead guilty. And nothing could change his mind. Attorneys spent hours with him. I was present several times, trying to convince him to plead insanity.
On the 5th of August, 1978, Berkowitz appeared in court.
Everybody was surprised when Berkowitz walked into court and instead of demanding a trial, he pled guilty to everything. And so the biggest case in the United States, the most highly publicized serial killer in the United States, suddenly pled guilty, and that was pretty much the end of the case.
On the 6th of December, Berkowitz was sentenced to a total of 365 years in prison. So what made Berkowitz murder? Was it the discovery of his adoption? Was it his unstable and isolated life? Or was the son of Sam simply born to kill?
He was not born to kill. In the sense of, can you say that there is a definite urge there to do it? He had the genetic makeup, yes. But the genetics was added on to by the environment. It was added on to by his maturing into his adolescent years. where the brain function starts to work on the gene, and then you have all of the beginning fantasies to kill.
So we've got a great deal of anger in his life about adoptive mothers who will die and therefore leave him, stepmothers coming into his life that he doesn't like. So these are the patterns of behavior that make David Berkowitz the killer that he became. But was he born to kill? I don't think David Berkowitz was born to kill. I think how he was socialized over a long period of time turned him into a killer.
I think a compelling case could be made that Berkowitz was born to kill. I think that there are certain kinds of mental illness that are hardwired into people. I mean, I think the more neurologists study the brain, the more they find that the presence of certain chemicals in the brain and the way they operate can compel people to engage in certain activities. And it seems clear to me that he suffered from severe mental illness and that mental illness drove him to kill.
What it is not is a result of poor parenting or some watershed event that happens in someone's life. There's thousands and thousands of people that have been adopted and don't do anything even close to what Berkowitz did. Berkowitz is a serial sexual murderer, and these individuals murder because there's a fusion of sex and aggression so that the aggressive act itself is eroticized. It's sexually stimulating for them. That's why they repeat it, because it is so sexually arousing and sexually stimulating. A number of people have said the overwhelming majority of serial sexual murderers kill up close and personal. Very, very rarely did they shoot somebody. Therefore, how do you explain David Berkowitz falling within that category? But you have to look at the first victim. The first victim that Berkowitz tried to kill was a woman, and he did it with a knife, except he didn't kill her. And so he then reverted to a method of killing that he was most comfortable with.
Psychiatrist Dr. Daniel Schwartz, who had examined David Berkowitz after his capture, would later receive a letter from prison.
He wrote me a letter, the substance of which was that all of these statements about God and the demons and so on were malingering, faking. In fact, his letter reads to begin with, quote, "I'm a faker. I made the demon story all up from the beginning. The reason for this was to try to mentally justify and cause for the crimes I committed. I knew there were no real demons, witches, talking dogs, and satanic henchmen. When I started committing these crimes, I had no idea of what motivated me. I decided that the demons as a cause would be appropriate. This is also why I pleaded guilty, because I knew I was."
I mean, what makes a person a killer? I don't know. You know, I'll never know, understand that totally, you know. But I don't believe anybody's born like that to have that in them, but I really don't know for sure. All the victims and lives that they destroyed, they're just innocent kids, just all having fun, just all at the prime of their life. And, you know, even the survivors, tremendous trauma, but I hope they're all doing well in their lives. I had never thought about that too much, but I'm saying it now that I just hope they're all doing well.